ESG was never a tick box how-to. It was to plant a seed to change culture in asset owners. And the Australian asset owners, Australia Super, firms like Cbus, were very much to the fore. It's about changing culture and thinking in a new planet where the world is changing. You have to adapt for that.
Welcome to The Greener Way. I'm your host, Michelle Baltazar, Executive Director of Media at Financial Standard Sustainability. We are recording on Gadigal land and we pay our respects to the traditional custodians of country and elders past, present, and emerging. We have a very special guest joining us on this episode. I will tell you by the end of this episode why that is, but certainly he is the man to talk about when we're talking about the past, present, future of ESG. Paul Clements Hunt, founder and chief executive of the Blended Capital Group, joins us and will be in Australia this year for the RIA conference. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Michelle, great to be with you. Looking forward to the trip to Australia as ever.
Yes. So let's talk about the Blended Capital first and the work that you do. And I know that you also have an office in Melbourne. Tell us about the Australian connection.
So I set up the Blended Capital Group. It will be 14 years old next February. And after I left the United Nations in 2012, and our focus is sort of what it says on the tin, Blended Capital. We look to create innovative financial structures to serve sustainability. And that's in two ways, you know, and at a macro level, sort of working with governments and big corporations, but also through impact in Sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, taking positions in interesting companies. The Australian connection is a long association with Oz, and also the fact that the Australian asset owner pool is so important at $4.2 trillion with very large pension funds. They play and will play a really influential role in defining responsible investment. So it's that double bag. I guess in the simplest terms, it's we're looking at taking one of our businesses in distributed infrastructure into the Pacific Islands. So Australia is a good launch pad for that. But in terms of the bigger picture, the macro picture, even the meta picture, Australia will play a huge role, in coming decades in the move to responsible investment and regenerative capitalism.
I agree. And certainly when we talk about ESG, a lot of super fund chief executives, it's definitely leading from the top, where more than a decade ago, they were at the forefront of the conversation. They were talking about the UN principles. So it's great to see that connection between yourself and the Blended Capital and the Australian superannuation community. Now, I did say that there's a reason why we're talking to you about ESG and what could potentially be ESG 4.0. I'm sure you've spoken about this many times, but if it's okay with you, can you share with our listeners, what was the genesis of the term ESG? How did that come about?
I go back to time in the UN, 2012. I ran a partnership between the UN with banks, insurers, asset managers. We started very small. There were just two people. And through the early 2000s, grew a team. And actually, one of your compatriots, James Gifford, joined us at UNFFI, I think about 2002-03. And he brought the nub of the idea, which became the responsible investment principles or principles for responsible investment. So look, it was a really dynamic early time, and we were quite a disruptive renegade team in the context of the UN. We asked for forgiveness, not permission. What we looked at was how do you align the interests of the peoples of the world, and the UN at the time, and still now, has the logo, we the people, with the financial system. And one of the ways was doing that was through pension systems, to make sure that pension systems were investing in planet, for profit, just protect community, the whole environmental kick. And that was the nub of the idea. So ESG actually was one of the simple tools that we developed to move that process forward. And we launched the Principles of Responsible Investment in 2006 with Kofi Annan at the New York Stock Exchange. Australians were very important in the evolution of the process. And, today we've got 5,500 institutions and $121 trillion. Does that mean everything's solved? No, but it's a very strong signal to the market that systemic risk, climate change, resource depletion, social inequality, all of those different complex issues are an important risk for long-term asset owners. And at the same time, there's huge opportunity in rewiring the planet. If I come back to ESG, so ESG, we wanted to move away from ethical investments, socially responsible investment. So the path we went down was we looked at the financial materiality and the fiduciary duty of investors in a changing world. We came up with the formula ESG. Now, it should have been governance, environmental, social, GES, governance. If you don't get that right, you get nothing right. But sitting in my office with a group of five team members in May 2004, we were knocking it about. Should it be GES, SGE? What should it be? And I guess I was a tabloid journalist in the 80s back in the UK. And my instinct was, look, if you start something with word governance, it's a technical word. It's dry. It's difficult. So let's swap that to the back. Environment is quite sexy. And at the time, even then, we were beginning to get metrics around environment. Mm-hmm. Humans can touch environment. They can feel it. And the most difficult thing for all investors and businesses is to get the social bit right. And that's so often knocked off, forgotten, flicked off, I always say, by Milton Friedman-esque lobbyists. So we welded it in the middle. And that was it. ESG 1-2-3, as easy as ABC. So there was no great science to it. It was much more this idea that, and let me stress this, it's not E and S and G. Mm-hmm. For many people, that's what it's become. It's become drop-down menus for asset managers and corporates where they tick boxes. ESG is about changing the culture in asset owners. That's what it was originally. And it was to change the culture to make them think, yes, you know, our assets are a danger from these long-term risks. You know, again, climate's the obvious one, but social inequality. So it was made them to think in terms of broader, what is my fiduciary duty in a changing planet? So again, it's a point I want to stress. ESG was never a tick box how-to. It was to plant a seed to change culture in asset owners. And the Australian asset owners, Australia Super, firms like Cbus, were very much to the fore. It's about changing culture of thinking in a new planet where the world is changing. You have to adapt for that.
I felt that you're quite right that it kind of branched out. One branch went out to ESG being a box-ticking exercise. But definitely here in Australia, it was taken as a holistic approach to how do we protect the environment, people, and also our superannuation members' wealth.
I have a theory, Michelle, that's Anglo-Saxon asset management. And I say asset management. You know, we know how they love formulate lists and data and matching things and assessing and rating things. And I think there was a co-option of ESG to fit asset management and broader finance. And that piece of the cultural change has been lost. But I actually mm-hmm. think at 20 years on, we're coming back to that. We live in a world of such challenge and such change. People understand that, you know, we're not going to sort a failing political economy by technical reporting disclosure efforts. We have to think much more broadly. And I think we're coming back to that authentic conversation now. And I'm really pleased about that. And that's in part what I'll be speaking to at RIA.
Now, let's talk about these authentic conversations, because there's a sense that the pendulum has swung to the opposite side, where we now talk about greenwashing and greenhushing. Why do you think that's kind of gathered pace, and how can the industry move away from some of the negative perception?
Look, business and industry shifts when the political wind shifts. It depends what degree you shift as a business. And I think the greenwashing, the greenhushing is understandable in the context of what we're seeing in terms of, you know, the shift to the right, the shift to autocracy, you know, very strident regimes, the anti-woke movement, what's mm-hmm. happening in America. But what I do say at the same time is companies and investors going forward will be judged particularly by the next generation for their authenticity. You can't one day be, a shining knight of ESG mm-hmm. and then take your cloak off and run to the other side. That's really difficult reputationally. So I think companies and boards need to be much more nuanced. So to come back to your point, you know, of course, business and investment shifts when the political wind veers, and we've seen it veer. But a point I keep stressing is, the systemic risks and the upside opportunity of ESG are still there. Doesn't matter what the acronym is, the opportunities of rewiring the planet and fixing it for the 21st century. It's the biggest investment opportunity you could ever wish for. So again, you know, we're in a storm. We're passing through the storm. Can we move from extractive capitalism, which we've seen for the last 250 years, which has served, you know, a group on the planet, but a very small group very well? Can we move through to regenerative capitalism? That's the key challenge. We're in the heart of the storm. We don't know the answer, but we do know that asset owners will play, you know, a very determinant role in that in terms of their decisions.
I want to come back to that topic of regenerative capitalism, but I want to rewind back to what you said about it doesn't matter what the acronym is, because there's also this latest development about fund managers or insto investors moving away from ESG to now saying it's sustainability. Can you just clarify, does it really matter? Has that changed?
Let me just put it into context, right? Over 40 years, what business and asset managers have done is they've, you know, we've seen corporate social responsibility, social responsible investment, ethical investment, triple bottom line investing, sustainable finance, responsible. They all get used until the marketing juice goes out of them, right? So the really simple form here is that if a business and a company or an investment is honest and it looks at the world and it sees the challenges, right? The systemic challenges, the big planetary ones, which are beginning to affect us locally now, and you in Australia know that full well in terms of both heat and flood. You know, we're seeing challenges of climate change manifest. We're seeing deepening social inequality. These are the real risks which are defining the next few decades. So for any business or investor, large pension fund, you have to ask the question, how do I manage it? How do I mitigate and transfer risk? How do I unlock value of the future, right? So, you know, I've now come to the point where if you look at that 20 or 30 years of, you know, taking acronyms, whatever they are, using them for a while and then dispensing them. Look, I look at now as a Rubik's Cube, right? You know, one side of the Rubik's Cube is ESG. It doesn't matter how you flip the Rubik's Cube, what the letters end up as, the environmental, the social, and the governance risks, whether at a strategic macro level, ever, or a sectoral level for a business or an industry or operational or individual executives. Those risks are not changing. They are our current reality and they're crying out for new political economy. So the acronym game is dangerous. You know, again, understanding the business in a difficult political context, you know, boards should look to the way they describe things. They should look to the way they move forward their authentic agenda, but do not abandon it. Abandon that at your peril. And we've seen some companies doing it. And I think it's very short term. And I think it's really, really poor strategic management by boards who do that.
Now let's move away from the naming convention to the practicalities of investing. What do you think is the next in the world of ESG investing? Where are the opportunities? I know that you've mentioned it in a paper that you've recently published called ESG 4.0, Complex Converging Systemic Risk in an Autocratic World. And you've talked about systemic risk. But for super funds, as they are now with less legislation arguably against them, working against them, what are the opportunities?
Look, first of all, I think the challenge for super funds is really significant. Because there's that perpetual and, you know, never-ending challenge of long-term and short-term. And, you know, we see so many of the big risks in the long-term. It's always tomorrow. But tomorrow's coming closer, right? Mm-hmm. And the near-term challenge is that, you know, returning inflation plus 4%, if you put it at a basic level, to protect assets, the assets of their beneficiaries over the long-term. So it's that dual challenge, which is really significant. What I see happening with ESG is I think, you know, the next 5-10 years will be an era of authenticity. And companies and investors need to manage their authenticity. How do they address this agenda? You know, do they move to a different form of language? That's fine. But in terms of building it into their investment strategy, I think, you know, there's a number of things on the horizon, which are really, really positive. One of the things I'll speak to in Australia is the move from, let's take carbon, is the move from carbon credits, which we've seen over the last 10, 20 years evolve with some controversy. Mm-hmm. We're moving into a period of tradable carbon securities, and that's not just for climate, it's also for nature. If you look at what the International Swaps and Derivatives Association are doing, that's a body created in 1984 to, you know, basically underpin the whole world of swaps and derivatives and to create standards and to create contracts. They're beginning for the first time to look at climate change. They left it until March of 2024 to create a climate change body. And they're now very seriously looking at the evolution of how we trade securities, not credits. So what does that actually mean? That is opening up a huge multi-trillion dollar market, right? If you look at the policy process in the UN, it's been long, it's been elongated. I've been to something like 20 plus COPs. My first was COP 4 in 1998. So I've watched the financial side of that. There is coming a maturity around that. So again, let me stress this without getting too technical. The shift from carbon credits and loose markets, voluntary markets, to a situation where the world's largest financiers can, whether it be the national or the subnational, the sub-sovereign or the corporate level, begin to trade carbon or nature-based securities, those markets will be upon us in the next 5 years. And that is a game changer. And what that is about is that's about finance, the financial system waking up to the fact that you're going to make more money saving the planet than you are destroying it. I think we're at that point now. Now, that's something that asset owners need to watch very carefully. And then you can understand how those new markets are evolving. So it's not illusory. You know, I've been working on that for the past year and a half in Brazil. We've actually taken a product into the US, and there's something called the Howey test. The Howey test goes back to the 1930s, and it's a four-point test to uncover whether something like it is a security.
Uh-huh.
Is it actually a security in a legal sense, or it's not? So we've actually got products in the tradable carbon securities shape which have passed the Howey test. It's the very, very, very beginnings of a market. It's nascent. But those are the type of things that I think asset owners have got to track and follow closely. It's quite technical, gets technical quite quickly. It's not carbon credits. It's the difference. A credit, in the way they're configured now, is a liability on your balance sheet. A proven security is an asset. That's a complete game changer. And again, last point on that, the world's largest financial institutions are beginning to look really seriously at that because they can see trillion-dollar markets unfolding in a way that we can hardly imagine. That's a convergence of monitoring technology. It's a convergence of technologies of understanding different biospheres. The whole carbon data and collection and monitoring piece is changing the way we will trade security.
I'm actually thinking about it and my head is spinning because I think whether or not you're in the business of investing, people understand the difference between an asset and a liability. Can you name the financial institutions that are already looking into these or exploring the market?
You know, I think there's a race to market. I think all the big investment banks and, you know, whether that's Goldman's or JP Morgan or it's Deutsche or it's HSBC, all the big players or your Australian banks, NAB or Westpac, I think they're at the very edge. Hey, let's take a forest biosphere. You know, what we can do now, we could not have done 10 years ago. So the ability to track and monitor and verify and show that emissions, avoided emissions or reduced emissions are real and attach that to financial engineering. I think that is that's the coming space. But don't let me dwell too long on that. I think, again, for asset owners, if we take another asset class, if you take infrastructure, I think we're beginning to see the work in place, which is linking particularly climate to infrastructure. So, you know, what is sustainable infrastructure? What is climate-aligned infrastructure? And for some of the largest investors who actually invest in real assets and alternatives, you know, the easy entree to climate investment, I think, is through infrastructure. And that's beginning to happen. We're also seeing the importance of adaptable and resilient infrastructure. You know, what is the infrastructure that's going to withstand both intense heat and greater flooding over the next few decades? These are questions that are both being asked, but we're also seeing on the technical side, the evolution of standards around sustainable infrastructure. There's a standard called the FAST infrastructure standard, which you know, the World Bank and the IFC and a lot of the banks are looking at. So again, on the deep investment size, large ticket size, and a lot of institutional investors are under allocated to infrastructure. I think infrastructure is going to become increasingly interesting in terms of both resilient infrastructure, but also the evolution of green infrastructure and green energy hubs around the world.
Well, that is an exciting prediction to hear. Paul, once again, thank you for joining us. This is The Greener Way. I'm your host, Michel Baltazar. Thank you for listening.
The Greener Way podcast is a product of FS Sustainability. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, legal, or tax advice. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement, and if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the FS Sustainability website, fssustainability.com.au.